You are listening to the Regent College Podcast.
Hello, I'm Nick Corbin.
And I'm Claire Perini.
And welcome back to the Regent College Podcast.
You're so excited, Nick.
I'm really excited.
I don't know if you're excited to see me or if you're excited about who we're talking to today. We had we have just had a great conversation with Dr. Barnabas Asprey, who is a lecturer in philosophy of religion at King's College in London. But Barney's a Regent grad, so he did a degree in computer science, and then he's done various degrees in theology and graduated from the University of Cambridge with his PhD in 2019. And Barney's current research project is the development of a political ethics of immigration from an ecumenical Christian perspective. So sort of understanding the role of the nation state, its relationship to human rights and individual and communal rights as well. And he has a way of sort of using the biblical narrative as well as kind of his understanding of theology as well as philosophy in how we understand and how we might respond well as Christians to the increasing number of migrants, both forced migration as well as voluntary migration in the world. We had a great conversation with him and just sort of talking about how do we understand this biblically, and then how do we make the jump of what goes on biblically,
right,
you know, into the 21st century context, which, you know, there are, we can, but how and what aspects of that do we carry over from the Old Testament or the biblical world into the current landscape?
Yeah, like the particularities of the biblical time, and then how does that fit into our time? It was such a fun and insightful conversation. Asking questions around what does the Bible actually say about refugees, and just a little interesting fact is that Barney kind of pointed out how few major characters of the Bible actually weren't refugees, meaning most of them were refugees. And he pinpointed three major figures in the Bible that were refugees. So you have to listen in to hear who those were and a little bit more about how to navigate these difficult questions and ethical issues around refugees.
Yeah, we got a little bit of Bible quiz. He Bible quizzed us a little bit in the middle there, didn't he?
He's such a professor, you know, such a teacher.
Just back to that question on you.
Yeah.
So, friends, we hope you enjoy our conversation with Dr. Barnabas Asprey. Barney, welcome to the Regent College Podcast.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure. I'm very excited to be here.
Yeah, we're excited to have a conversation with you. Tell us a little bit. You and I studied at Regent together. And so, but I don't know if you were thinking about the things we're about to talk about while you're at Regent, but that's not important. Tell us a little bit about kind of your connection to Regent, how you came to Regent, and then sort of what happened after that.
Yeah, well, I came to Regent for a number of reasons, but one of them involves the fact that they were one of the few institutions that would let me do a master's degree in theology, having not done an undergrad in theology. I did an undergrad in computer science, which is a little bit different, bit of a shift, bit of a jump. But basically, I hadn't quite figured out what I was really interested in when I was choosing my undergrad. To be honest, I didn't really know the word theology or what theology was. I'd grown up in a church context which had many strengths and was very wonderful in many ways, but it wasn't particularly intellectual and it wasn't particularly theologically focused or motivated. And so I grew up with a great passion for the Bible and for questions about God, and I just didn't know that there was a name for that and you could go and study that somewhere. So I just picked computer science because it seemed like an obvious choice to get a job.
Yeah.
And then while I was doing computer science, I got to know all these theology students and I was like, I'm far more interested in what they're doing than in what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So then I basically worked as a software engineer for a few years, saved as hard as I could until I could afford to quit my job and go to Regent.
Yeah. And you did your degree at Regent, and then what happened after that?
Well, I did a biblical studies concentration at Regent, but then after that I changed tack and I decided I didn't want to become a biblical scholar. I always wanted to use the Bible a lot in my work, but I was more drawn to systematic theology and philosophical theology because of the way that it asks the questions about what is true for today in light of the Bible. So after Regent, I actually went to Cambridge and did another master's degree, this time in systematic theology. And then stayed at Cambridge for the PhD, this time in philosophical theology. I keep changing my mind. I don't really know.
Yeah, I was
going to
say, which one do you want? Yeah. Systematic, philosophical? What's, what about
I don't
just,
know.
Yeah.
Just a confused fellow, that's all.
What's the difference? Can you tell us quickly the difference between those two?
Okay, well, I think systematic theology, my summary of it is systematic theology asks, in light of the Christian tradition and the Bible, what is true about God and the world? I would say philosophical theology asks deeper questions about why we think that's true and how that relates to what other people think about what is true outside the Christian tradition and perhaps what we can learn from them, but also how we can defend the Christian faith against criticisms that come from outside as well. So philosophical theology is more about digging down into the fundamental reasons that people believe things and where Christianity sits in that sort of spectrum.
What a great answer.
So wait, where did you say you landed?
The PhD was in philosophical theology, but it doesn't stop there.
Okay.
So I then keeps went going. And did a postdoc in political theology, I guess.
Right.
As you do.
Makes sense.
I'm sorry, this sounds terribly confusing. No, it sounds great. But yeah.
Theology's in all of them, which is good. So we're seeing a thread there, so that's helpful. Yeah.
That's true, there's a thread. Something to do with God and the Bible.
There's definitely consistency in that. You just wanted to get all angles on the theological thought. So cool. We're talking about refugees, immigration, asylum, and you have spoken on this, you've written on this, but I wonder how did you become interested in researching, speaking about, delving into issues around refugee migration and asylum?
Well, I won't pretend that it was my idea to begin with. I was part of a church in London, a sort of church full of young people like myself. And one of the members of that church, while I was there, founded a refugee charity. And she needed a lot of help getting it started, a lot of voluntary help. So I just found myself getting drawn into helping out. I became the first treasurer of that charity and had some of the conversations around what we were going to name it and those kinds of things. Some of the sort of foundational chats about what this charity was going to do and be about. And I think due to this church friend's enthusiasm and passion for the plight of refugees, I just got drawn into seeing what an important issue that was and how refugees really are one of the most vulnerable and disadvantaged people or categories of people in the world today.
It's funny, isn't it, how actually – which is theology for life, right? So it's like, oh, I find myself in this situation where it's like, I have thought about this before, but I haven't thought about it before, but now actually what's going on in front of me makes me reflect theologically and biblically and all of that.
Yeah, totally. I'm a big fan of what Karl Barth calls double reading, doesn't he, which is where you're supposed to, as a Christian, you're supposed to have the newspaper in one hand and the Bible in the other, and you're supposed to make the two talk to each other. And sometimes you start with the Bible and then think, okay, well, how does this apply to today? But in my case, I would say I actually just started by looking at the world and seeing, wow, like forced migration is an ever-growing problem that we all need to deal with and think about. And there must be a Christian perspective on this. There must be a distinctively Christian way of looking at, thinking about, and acting with regard to the problem of huge numbers of refugees in the world.
And this is going to sound like an obvious question, but if can you kind of talk to us a little bit, what is a refugee? What's the difference between a migrant, an asylum seeker, a refugee? Sometimes asylum seeker and refugee kind of get they're a bit synonymous or they get kind of blurred together. What are the differences between, how do we understand those different types of people?
Oh, that's a great question and very important because I certainly had no idea what all these terms meant before I started reading up on it, and I think many people are confused about it. The official legal definition of a refugee is defined by a document called the 1951 Refugee Convention, where this was laid out under the UN, part of the UN Declaration of Human Rights. And the official legal definition is a refugee is somebody who has well-founded reason to fear persecution from their home state due to reasons of political opinion, ethnicity, various aspects of their identity, and thus cannot avail themselves of the support of their home state and has been forced to flee their home state. So that's a refugee. An asylum seeker is somebody who has claimed that about themselves, that they've fled to another country and they've claimed asylum in another country, and they are awaiting a decision from the country they're in on whether they're going to be granted refugee status or not. So an asylum seeker, the jury's out, as it were, quite literally, you know, on whether or not they count as a refugee.
They would identify as that and would say that, according to that definition, I fall under that commission, that, but the country that they're in has to decide whether that's true. Is that right?
Yeah, whether to grant them, because if they do grant them refugee status, then under the UN Declaration of Human Rights, that nation that they fled to has a whole lot of responsibilities and duties towards that person they've just counted as a refugee, that otherwise they don't.
That makes
sense. And I think in reality, there are many, many people in the world who I would call forcibly migrated who don't strictly fall under that legal definition because they're not an individual who's been persecuted by the state. Maybe they fled because of famine, or maybe there's just been a massive war and like a million people have been displaced and forced to flee. And then they don't technically fall under that definition, but I think they still ought to be counted as refugees because they need all the same help and support that a legal refugee does.
Right, totally. And
so then that's where you would say then that would be the a migrant would be in that, in the terms of the forced migration, would be someone who is, doesn't fall under that technical definition but can't live in their home state.
A migrant is anybody who just doesn't live in their home state. They might have chosen to, like, you're probably a migrant.
I was going
to
say, Nick and I are migrants.
Right. Yeah, you're both migrants.
Yeah,
I'm for once in my life not a migrant. I'm actually living in the country I was born in. But for a long time, I lived elsewhere.
A migrant
just means anybody who's not living in their home state.
Yeah, right.
And then we specify a forced migrant as somebody who they left their home state even though they wanted to stay. Because their life was in danger, or their rights, or their privileges, their freedom was in danger. Something was in danger and they had to leave even though they would have rather stayed.
No, it makes sense. I mean, and based on, I guess, each of these categories or where you are maybe on the spectrum of them will depend on like the level of either help or assistance that you'll require. I mean, granted, like Claire and I being migrants, you know, almost kind of by choice chose, but there's still a level of, obviously it's like not to the same degree. There's still a level of moving into a different area that you're in a different culture, you're learning and adapting to, but still maybe to not that extreme, somebody like a refugee or somebody who's been forcibly displaced.
You're not forced. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll need a different type
of care. Absolutely. I mean, when you choose to go to another country, certainly you have to deal with certain culture shock, and maybe it's that there's another language you have to learn. But you know where you're going. You probably have accommodation arranged before you show up, and you bring all of your possessions with you, and you can still go home anytime you like and see your family and friends. What makes the plight of a refugee so much worse is, I mean, if you imagine you were like flying back home to Australia via Japan, and you stopped in the airport of Japan, and then all of a sudden there was a big war or disaster or something, and you couldn't go to Australia, and your luggage was lost, and you were just in the middle of Japan. You didn't speak Japanese, you didn't know anybody, and you can't go anywhere. You just have to make life work there for you don't know how long. It might be a few days, or it might be a few years. You just don't know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what it's like to be a refugee, really.
Yeah.
One of the things you mentioned is delving into this was not necessarily through reflecting on scripture, but you were kind of confronted with it with the people around you. I wonder if you can share with us like what then scripture has to say about refugees, if anything. Like, and maybe a question with that too is, in your time, even before you were surrounded by this church or in this experience, like, did you reflect on that at all prior to like what scripture had to say about refugees, or was it in that time period that it really came?
I have to say, I didn't think about it before. Mm. It's one of these funny principles of hermeneutics, you know, theory of interpretation of text and interpretation of the Bible, that if you apply a certain hermeneutic lens to something, mm-hmm. you suddenly see all kinds of things yeah. that you had no idea were there before.
Right.
And this experience happened to me, and it's also happened to people who have taught about refugees in the Bible as well, is that all of a sudden when I start thinking about the Bible from a perspective of forced migration, I'm like, oh my gosh, refugees mm-hmm. are everywhere in the
everywhere.
Bible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The whole Bible is full of forced migration. Why have I not seen this before?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Yeah, totally. So what is it? What stood out to you as you sort of were like, oh my goodness, it's kind of everywhere? Were there certain ideas or certain kind of ways of that scripture kind of thinks about or talks about mm-hmm. refugees? I mean, it documents refugees. There's definitely that, like tons, as you say, tons of stories. But what does scripture say in terms of?
I tend to divide what scripture says into sort of two main categories. The first category is a softer category. It's stories describing the experiences of refugees and just describing the reality of what it's like to be a refugee. Because as we know, like the Bible isn't just a set of commands or a set of propositions. The Bible is a story. That's something that I learned when I was at Regent. That was a big theme at Regent. The Bible is a story.
Mm-hmm.
And so it tells a lot of stories of refugees. That's one category. And then the other category is the actual more legal commands about how you are supposed to treat refugees, how you're supposed to treat the stranger. We can talk a little bit later about the Hebrew word for stranger and the interesting things about that. But first of all, just looking at the experiences of refugees in the Bible, I wonder if you could name for me some people who you can think of in the Bible, some biblical characters
mm-hmm.
who were forced to flee their homeland for any reason at all.
Well, I mean, Abraham isn't forced. I mean, is he forced? He's invited, you know, that, you know, leave your country, your people, and your father's household. Is he forced? Yeah. I don't know, Nick. Is he forced?
He's forced later on.
Yeah, he is forced later on.
So first of all, he chooses. Yeah. He's a migrant because God tells him go, and he obeys God. But then within the same chapter in Genesis 12, it says there's a famine and they flee to Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
So then Abraham's a refugee. So that's one. Nick, any more biblical characters are refugees?
Got any thoughts?
I mean, Joseph was like he was sold and then forced mm-hmm. into a different. But then you could also say out of Egypt, like Moses, like they grew up within Egypt, but they were forcibly dispersed.
Moses, well, I mean, Moses was forced to flee. I mean, you might have said mm-hmm. it might be a bit more legitimate because he killed somebody and was exiled.
Right.
But he was still a refugee. He was forced to flee where he had grown up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Ruth and Naomi.
Yeah, actually, I don't think Ruth counts as a refugee.
Oh, no, she doesn't. Because they're exiled. Yeah. That's what I was going to say. Then what's the difference between being exiled?
Naomi is a refugee because she fled due to famine.
Mm-hmm.
But Ruth very clearly chose to go back with Naomi.
Yes, of course.
So Ruth is just a migrant.
Jesus?
Jesus, absolutely. Yeah.
I'm just moving through my way through the story here.
So there's a few less known stories in the life of King David.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He has to flee, first of all, from threat of being killed by Saul. Mm-hmm. And then later on, after he's king, he flees because his son Absalom is out to mm-hmm. get him to usurp his place as king.
Right.
So David's a refugee. So basically, we're naming basically all of the major characters in the Bible. All of the major characters in the Bible were refugees at one point or another. So that suggests to me that this is kind of an important topic. It's mm-hmm. kind of an important theme.
Yeah. Somewhere, maybe, yeah.
Hagar.
Hmm?
Hagar.
Hagar, yeah, yeah. Hagar, yeah. I mean, we can keep going. I actually just started making an opposite list, to be honest. I started listing the people, the biblical characters who were not refugees, and I only came up with three significant ones.
Who were they?
Yeah, right.
Solomon, Samuel, and Elijah.
Oh.
Right.
Basically, wow. Everybody else I can think of at some point
yeah.
fled their country.
Yeah.
To save their life or their freedom or something.
So yeah. interesting to reflect on.
And so just making sure I'm tracking. So you said there were two categories, kind of there's the yeah. stories of people. Did you say yeah. the second category?
Well, the second category is, I say like basically the first category is looking at life from the perspective of refugees.
Right, right.
The second category is looking at life from the perspective of the host nation.
Right.
Or the native. Mm. What should we who are comfortably settled in a country how should we treat the refugee? How should we treat the stranger? Mm. And there's a whole lot of commands about that in mm-hmm. in the Old Testament law, the Torah. It's actually one of the most frequent mentions, one of the most frequently used words in the whole of the Torah is the word for stranger, which is the Hebrew word ger. It's normally transliterated G-E-R, the ger. There's a lot of controversy around how that word should be translated, though, because it's not the only word for stranger. There's actually four Hebrew words for stranger, for foreigner in the Hebrew language. There's nokri or nekar, which just means any foreigner, anyone who's not part of my nation. Mm-hmm. So they could be living in their own foreign country. They're just a foreigner. Then there's zar, which basically means anybody who doesn't belong to my in-group. Then there's Toshav, which sort of seems to mean a kind of temporary traveler, somebody who's passing through. Mm-hmm. And then there's Ger. And there's been books written about this word on both, this is a hot political debate, especially in the Western world right now. Mm-hmm. And when there's passages in like Leviticus and Deuteronomy, which say, you should love the Ger as yourself, for you were Gerim in the land of Egypt. It's a pretty clear and strong command. So it becomes very important to know exactly what kind of people are being mentioned here. Mm-hmm. The growing consensus among biblical scholarship is that the Ger actually specifies a vulnerable, displaced person. In other words, somebody who has been displaced against their will. They probably don't have family to support them. They certainly don't have land, because if you're in Israel and you're not a native Israelite, you obviously don't have land. And land and family are the only two ways that you can get income and support in the ancient world, right? Mm-hmm. They don't have national insurance or human rights or anything like that. If you don't have land and you don't have family, you're in bad shape.
Mm-hmm.
And that's who the Ger is.
Right.
Is somebody who doesn't have any other means of support than, well, basically that's why God has to come in the Torah and say, you need to look after these people because they don't have anybody else to look after them.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, so interesting. It's like those other words that you mentioned that describe the stranger that are mentioned in scripture, like they're important, but there's something about the specific word usage of the ger, which is the stranger, those who don't have anything, that is actually the significant piece.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can see, so there's one Bible passage where three of the four words for foreigner are used all at once, and it's when it's defining who in Israel may partake of the what's it called again? I've forgotten its name. The supper. The Passover supper, that's it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Who may partake of the Passover supper? And it says, no nokri may partake of it. No, just any, no foreigner can take it. No toshav, no traveler passing through, who may be a merchant. You know, they have their own means of support. They're not going to stay. If the ger wants to take it, then they have to get circumcised. In other words, they've got to start to integrate. They've got to commit to belonging to the people of Israel before they're going to be allowed to partake of this special meal, this unifying meal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting to see how these three words come to light in this defining passage. Who is Israel? Mm-hmm. Who are the people of Israel? Well, it's not these people. It's not these people. So they can't partake of this supper. But the vulnerable, displaced person, if they're willing to join Israel and start to obey Israel's own customs and laws, then they can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, so interesting.
Okay, let's talk about what words used in Isaiah 16. Go ahead.
Gair is not there in Isaiah 16.
So you've talked about Isaiah 16, about welcoming the refugee, particularly verse 3, stating, you know, hide the refugees, do not betray the refugees, let the Moabite fugitives stay with you, be their shelter from the destroyer. Give us, why would we be talking about Isaiah? Give us some context for that and how we understand this whole conversation.
Yes, I'm actually quite pleased with myself for finding this passage in Isaiah, because I haven't found it used in the other literature on the Bible and refugees. So that's my own like unique contribution. Is look right. Guys, Isaiah 16 is also talking about
something.
Refugees. Let's use that. Yeah, exactly. But the thing is, it doesn't actually use that word "ger," which is probably why it's been overlooked. The context is, I mean, the whole context of Isaiah. Isaiah is one of the strongest books of the Old Testament to talk about what I would broadly call social justice, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know the word social justice can be quite politically controversial, especially in America.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean it in the most basic, generic sense. Social, just meaning care for the poor and the marginalized and the disadvantaged.
Mm-hmm.
Something that not many people would say you're not supposed to do.
Right.
And the book of Isaiah really front loads the importance of social justice all the way through. The Israelites are constantly chastised for not caring for the poor, and Isaiah is really the champion of the poor and the marginalized. So it shouldn't be a surprise if we see refugees crop up there. But there's another really unique and fascinating bit about Isaiah 16, or rather I should say Isaiah 15 and 16, because the passage as a whole starts in Isaiah 15 and goes on to the end of Isaiah 16. And in Isaiah 15, it describes the fall of the land of Moab. Moab is in a desperate situation. It's probably been attacked by the Assyrians, and Moabites are fleeing for their lives and scattering all over the place. And Moab is in a really desperate situation. But Isaiah 16 doesn't just describe it. It laments it. It grieves over it. Now, can you think of anywhere else in the Old Testament where grief is shown over a land that is not Israel? I can't.
No. I was wondering if it was a trick question.
It's really unique for a prophet to express so much grief and lament and sorrow over the plight of a non-Israelite nation. And again, I think this is just extraordinary. It shows the expansiveness of the vision for love of absolutely everybody that you find in Isaiah. Very sort of prophetic in the best sense is that he's looking forward to some of the themes that we find more strongly in the New Testament about it doesn't matter if you're Jewish or Greek, it doesn't matter all I want in Christ Jesus, God loves everybody, God cares about everybody, it doesn't matter where you come from. And you find this hinted at in all the way back in Isaiah, in things like Isaiah 15, where he's grieving over these Moabites. And then, of course, naturally, Moab shares a lot of border with Israel. So if Moab is under massive attack, there's going to be a whole load of Moabites fleeing for safety in Jerusalem. And so Isaiah 16 opens with this situation. And what we find is Isaiah saying, don't betray these guys. You let these guys in. You welcome these guys. You protect them from the intruder. It doesn't use the word ger there. It uses the word fugitive, actually. That's the closest English equivalent to the Hebrew word. And, of course, that can mean a number of different things.
Right.
But I think it doesn't use that word because there's something so urgent going on here. that these people are knocking at the doors of Jerusalem, and Isaiah is telling the Jerusalem officials, let them in, welcome them, look after them.
Yeah.
It's almost like it doesn't use the word ger because it's not necessarily, they're seeing these people in a different light. I don't know. Why wouldn't the passage use like a refugee, somebody who's ger, somebody who has been, doesn't have anything because they've just lost their land? Is there still like the understanding of like they're under attack, but they still have like the communal, they still have land. But in this meantime, like that they have it, you need to embrace them in this time.
You know, it's very interesting. I hadn't actually thought about it this far before. But I think what's happening is they're not yet the ger, because they haven't yet crossed over into Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
They're still technically in their own land, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the thing is, they're going to be killed if they stay in their own land.
Right.
So they're going to become ger, and it does use the verb form of ger, which is gur. It says, let them gur among you. Let them cross over and settle here.
Yeah,
But yeah, I don't know. That's a very interesting question. I hadn't thought about it that far.
Mm-hmm. And it says, and protect them from the destroyer, from those who are
exactly
seek to destroy.
It's translated all kinds of different ways. I mean, it's a very difficult passage in the Hebrew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I had to spend a lot of time arguing for various particularities of the Hebrew, which made some of my writings a bit too dense and boring to serve as a great popular book.
It's got to be enticing. I wonder, Barney, would the like embracing the Moabites been challenging to Isaiah's the prophet's audience at the time?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Moabites were the historic enemies of the Israelites, right? There's all kinds of wars they've had with them. And these guys worship foreign gods anyway. We don't want to have anything to do with people who worship foreign gods. And there's a lot of history between them. You think of nations today that have a lot of history between them. You think of some of the conflicts that go on between Palestine and Israel today. It's actually a very similar sort of conflict.
Mm-hmm.
But all other places in the world, there's a memory of woundedness, of offense, of memory of people whose grandparents were killed maybe in some war between the Israelites and the Moabites. So they're not just asking... Isaiah's not just asking the Israelites to welcome some poor, vulnerable stranger who they otherwise don't know. He's asking them to welcome their arch enemies, their former foes, in the moment of their desperate need.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's so interesting. And maybe I'm reading into it too much, but kind of what you said at the beginning with Ger, those who are forcibly displaced, don't have anything to embrace them. Let them come into the Passover meal. With the stipulation that they start to embrace some of the customs of circumcision and some of the, this is how Yahweh calls his people to act, to love. But in some sense, and again, I could be off here, they're called to embrace their enemy, the Moabites, even if they don't start to embrace like circumcision, even if they don't like have their same customs, like they're called to protect them, embrace them, even if they don't act like Israel.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I think that's right. And it's one of the constant problems today about the plight of a refugee. And it's also a problem for the policymakers of a nation that hosts refugees. Is the question is, how long do you let them stay here? Because if they stay here for 20 years, then they probably should learn your language and get a bit familiar with your culture just for their own sake, apart from anything else. And they should be given visas, they should be allowed to work, they should be given the same rights as any other citizen. But what if they're only going to stay here for like 3 months?
Right.
Then how do you treat them? And then the question is, but you don't know whether they're going to stay here for 3 months or for 20 years. Because whatever it was that made them flee their homeland, think of the Ukraine war going on now, for example. We've had, you know, hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians, well, millions of Ukrainians, but hundreds of thousands have come to the UK. And we've no idea if they can go back tomorrow or if they're going to be in the UK the rest of their lives.
Yeah. It's totally out. Yeah, that's right. What's forced them to leave is completely outside their control, and their ability to return is completely outside their control. Yeah. Or not complete. Yeah.
So what would you say? Yeah. Like, there seems to be like particularities to specifically Israel's time that you're like bridging over now to our time. Like, are you kind of saying maybe we can just think of you, the Ukrainian example. This maybe a simple example is somebody might say one thought might be like, well, they need to come in. If they're going to come in, they need to learn our customs and how we do things and how we do life. Another thought might be, well, we want them to maintain their customs. So let's try and set up a structure for them, schools for them, where they can be taught in their language. They can continue on almost like a subculture within that. I don't know. Maybe we want to dive into the current modern day of like.
Yeah, I mean, it's very tricky. It's a big hermeneutical question about how you translate some of these Old Testament laws. And it may sound easy the way I said it. You know, it says in Leviticus, you shall love the stranger as yourself. So done and dusted, we should all love the stranger as ourselves today. Mm-hmm. But then if you look at a few verses later in Leviticus, it's telling you how to like sacrifice a cow, or it's telling you not to sew your clothes out of two different types of linen. You know, it's not an obvious thing how to translate, how to apply some of these Old Testament passages to today. And I think the biggest difference between the Old Testament time and our own, for the purposes of this discussion, is that there was no such thing as a nation state back then, right?
Mm-hmm.
There was no such thing as the rise of the nation state, which sort of happened. It started in the 17th century in Europe, after the end of the 30 Years' War, when certain boundaries were defined for the first time. And then it culminated probably in the First World War at the beginning of the 20th century, when a lot of these nations were properly and completely defined in the way that we know them today. In the ancient world, there were people who had to flee their home because of famine or because there were invaders marauding or whatever, but they could just go and settle somewhere else. It wasn't a problem in quite the same way. I mean, sure, you had to leave your home behind, you had to rebuild your home, whatever. That's tragic. But in the modern world, if you have to flee your home state, you don't have anywhere else to go except another state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The entire world is divided into nation states, apart from some bits of the ocean, and good luck trying to live there.
Yeah.
Right. Antarctica.
Yeah, exactly. So you've got nowhere to go. If your own state is threatening to kill you, mm-hmm. where do you go except to another state? And that state has the power to let you in or to not let you in.
Mm-hmm.
And so that creates this big problem. That's why I think there are more refugees in the world today than there ever have been before. Mm-hmm. It's not that there have never been people forced to flee their homes before. It's that the people now who are forced to flee their homes have nowhere else to go.
Yeah, the resettlement process was, I mean, not easier. As you say, you've still got to uproot but you haven't got to deal with another state. You just have to deal with the travel to that spot as opposed to, the rules surrounding that.
And there's laws, there's borders, there's border enforcement, there's police, you know, officials, all these people who are going to find you and say, what are you doing here? Yeah. Where's your passport? Where's your visa? Yeah. You don't belong here. I'm going to send you back where you came from.
Yeah, mm-hmm. right.
And so trying to define a refugee in a way that applies to both the Bible and today is difficult. And I've sort of hedged that a little bit, haven't I? Because I've just talked about people who were forced to flee and I've defined them as refugees. But I also said earlier that that's not the official definition of refugee. Mm-hmm. The official definition of refugee basically means that there's nobody who's a refugee before 1951.
Right.
So,
So how do we bridge those worlds? Because it's like you automatically want to go, yep, we need that. That makes sense. We should be doing, you know, but then of course the particularities are different because of the nation state thing. So why should Christians care? How do we sort of start to begin to think about this, given that the context is different? But I mean, we apply lots of things from the Bible, and the context of the Bible is always different from where those who are reading it, right? So right now. So I don't know, what are some of the things that we can take from it? What things do we need to be cautious of or kind of not apply?
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah.
Well, I mean, my own hermeneutic, my own way of going about this is to lay out very clearly what's different between now and the time of the Bible and be honest and open about that. And then underneath that, to think about what's the same, what doesn't change. And the first thing that doesn't change is God, who God is, God's character, mm-hmm. right? And so whatever the Bible reveals about God's character is still true now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It hasn't changed. And another thing that hasn't, well, another thing that's stable is that God has a people who he has designated as his own and who he wants to represent his character in the world. Now, of course, mm-hmm. that people has undergone a lot of changes. There used to be the Israelites, and now they're, well, for Christians, they're defined around Jesus now. So it's not as if that hasn't changed at all, but there's still a people who define themselves as God's people and who want to represent God's will and character to everybody around them.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, then we have to ask, well, how do we do that? Well, the Bible gives us some good clues by showing us how God wanted his people back then to represent his will and character to the people back then. And then that closes the gap a little bit, and you have to say, well, if somebody's was forced to flee their home and land up in Israel in the ancient times, God seems to think that the fact that they are vulnerable and the fact that they don't have any other means of support is a claim on you who do have the means of support, the claim on you who do have the comfort and the security of your own land and your own family around you. They have a claim on you to care about them and to provide for them.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And then it becomes not so hard to think right. about how that would work today. You know,
mm-hmm.
there's those kinds of people today. We're the people of God today. God is the same today. All right, let's go. Let's do this.
Yeah.
Barney, I love that posture and all right, let's go, let's do this. But that's oftentimes not what takes place both in Christians' life, but then as well as you see in the state and in the government.
And like we have stuff,
there's
yeah.
like so many different policies and stuff that seem to either limit the possibilities of things happening. So I guess my question is like, what are some of the difficult ethical questions around like when it comes to refugees? And I guess in light of maybe the Ukrainian war, which has kind of really spotlighted this, but really this has been going on for years. And there are many places in Africa, South America, where people are being forcibly displaced or having to flee or seeking asylum because of the chaos, the unrest in their own nations and cities. So it's obviously not a new thing, but I guess what are some of the difficult like questions that we're wrestling through today?
Well, I think one of the most difficult ethical questions is that there will be many migrants who pose as refugees who actually aren't. Not as many as the right-wing media makes it sound, but the thing is, if you do start to open your doors to anybody without checking too closely where they're mm-hmm. coming from and why they're coming, you will get people who try to take advantage of your generosity. And that creates problems for the home nation. In the UK, there's a large contingent of working class people who have working class jobs, not that skilled jobs, who really struggle now because there's so much competition from all of these migrants who have come that they often don't get enough work to feed themselves and their families. And that makes them very bitter and angry about all of these migrants who have come and taken our jobs, you know. And in a sense, that they're not entirely wrong. I don't want to just dismiss that as nonsense. They're not entirely wrong. It's easy for me as an educated middle-class person. Now, my job's not under threat from a refugee coming to replace me.
Mm-hmm.
But for the working classes, it is. And I think very often the people who are very strong advocates of refugees can dismiss some of the genuine concerns and difficulties that the people in our own nation struggle with because of the existence of migrants and refugees.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. One of the questions I have is, and maybe you have thoughts on this, is like, well, I've heard people say like, well, you know, they're gonna, like, how do we assimilate people? You know, this goes right back to the question of, like, how do we assimilate people to our culture? Do we assimilate people to our culture? Like, does bringing in refugees disrupt a culture and either language or tradition or ways of doing life? Mm-hmm. Like, those are, I don't know, do you have those picking at some of the ethical questions, or is there, like, something actually deeper there going on?
Yeah, no, it's a big difficult ethical question for sure. Assimilation, I prefer the word integration to assimilation. Assimilation sometimes means that basically somebody should leave behind their home culture entirely.
Right.
And just become, you know, if they're in America, they should just become 100% American and forget where they came from. Integration implies that they do need to meet the nation halfway, the culture halfway. They can't just hide in a little bubble and not learn the language. But they can retain some of the richness of the culture that they came from and some of those practices without leaving them entirely behind.
Yeah.
And I think there are difficulties there to note, because if you have so many migrants coming in to a nation, and if those migrants are very keen on preserving their own values, their own culture, their own practices, and their own priorities, a lot of people say that there's a danger of a lack of social cohesion, a lack of social trust, a lack of a feeling that we in this nation are all on a common journey together, and we trust each other, and we trust that those around us want the same things as us. And when you have that, then there's a danger that society starts to fragment and fall apart a little bit.
Yeah, there's always then the fear of the othering kind of thing as well, right? So it's like, I'm still, which doesn't make sense in a country, in any country that has a First Nations kind of population living there, as well as, you know, an Indigenous population and as well as a settler pop. Like, it gets really complicated really quickly, in the sense of, like, the integration is, you don't want, I can see what you mean. But then there also has to be, then there becomes an, like, the, you, yeah, I don't know, the disintegration, but you also don't want to be then forcing people to be someone that they're not, to fit in with you, the dominant, whatever the dominant culture is. So, and maybe I'm more sensitive to it coming from the Australian context and the Canadian context of the Indigenous story. But, you know, I'm just trying to understand, how do you then...
No, well, I don't think you should force people to be somebody they're not. But I do think that if we in our nation think that our laws are good laws and that we try to do things fairly and well... And if we're then welcoming people who have lost everything from their own culture, I do think you can at least expect them to obey our laws, and to sort of, it may be very, very tragic and very, very awful what they've had to go through to get to this country, but it's still sort of at most polite, or minimally polite, to try and conform to the norms that the country that they've arrived at. And I think anybody with any measure of decency would want to do that, right? They would want to learn the language and try and at least fit in a little bit without necessarily completely changing who they are.
Yeah, that integration piece is helpful, I think, that word usage. Barney, I wonder if you have thoughts on what we can do, or maybe Christians in general, people who claim to be followers of Jesus, can do practically in regards to refugees and the different issues and things that are going on.
Well, I think there's three things you can do. You can get involved politically. You can raise it with your local politicians as an issue that you care about. You ask them, what are you doing for refugees? What are you doing for immigrants? Second thing, very, very simply and straightforwardly, you can give financially to refugee charities that are trying to provide for these people. But thirdly, and this is perhaps the most challenging one and the most difficult thing to do, go and get to know some refugees. Go and find them. They're hard to find sometimes because they're sort of invisible. It's not so easy. You don't just meet somebody walking down the street and find out that they're a refugee, you know. But I would say to any Christian who's been persuaded that they ought to care about this, go and find a refugee charity who will who will pair you up with somebody, or go and find and get to know some of these people, because it will change your life. It will enrich you enormously. This isn't just an act of charity that we're being, so benevolent and gracious, and you can get a savior complex if you think about it that way. But if you get to know these people, you find out you've got tons to learn from them.
Yeah.
And from what they've gone through and from their stories.
Mm-hmm.
And they can come in and they can enrich our culture in the same way. But we have to get to know them first. We have to befriend them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's really good.
Yeah, which is the that level of investment is different than a financial investment or a political investment, right? It's that there's an investment of myself, which is actually totally what we need to be doing with anyone is the investment, and the mutuality and reciprocity of relationship. So good. Now, Barney, this has been so good to chat with you. We could go down all sorts of, we could keep going, but I also am conscious that you've written another book recently.
Oh man.
So I'm wondering, do you want to just tell us a little bit, kind of what are you working on just as we finish up here? What are you working on at the moment, or tell us a bit about your book or what you're working on now?
Well, thank you. I actually finished most of the manuscript for that book before I started working on the topic of refugees, and it doesn't sound like it's very similar in topic at all.
I did think
have to dig into the book. There are a lot of overlaps in content, but you'd have to read the book to know what it is, because on the surface it doesn't sound very similar.
Yeah.
It's basically a reworking of my PhD thesis, which was on the French philosopher, a fascinating French philosopher called Paul Ricoeur. Have you heard of him?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I have.
Yeah, well, there you go. I mean, I think Regent is a fan of Paul Ricoeur because they teach on the Masters of Suspicion, and Paul Ricoeur invented that idea of the Masters of Suspicion. What fascinated me about Ricoeur was that he won his way to being a famous philosopher in the non-Christian world, and yet somehow Paul Ricoeur managed to become a famous philosopher without losing his faith and without compromising his philosophy. And I just found that fascinating, so I wanted to learn more about him. And what I basically found is that he claims that you can't do philosophy in a neutral space, right?
Right.
So an atheist doesn't have an advantage over a Christian when it comes to doing good philosophy.
Right.
He doesn't ever depend on the Bible as an authority for what he's saying.
Uh-huh.
But he nonetheless is clearly using biblical themes throughout his work. And my book tries to draw out some of those biblical themes that appear in his philosophy. For example, the central question that Ricoeur wants to ask is, what does it mean to be a human being?
Mm-hmm.
What is a human being? And I think some Christians would be tempted to start defining a human being in terms of sin, right? Mm-hmm. To be human means to be sinful, means to be rebelled against God, original sin, Adam and Eve, fallen, that kind of stuff. But Ricoeur says that's not the beginning of the story. The beginning of the story, the very first thing it means to be a human being is to be created, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you're created, that means there's a creator.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so you stand as a human being automatically in relation to something that surpasses you.
Right.
That has constituted your very being.
Yeah.
And Ricoeur somehow manages to cash this out philosophically in a way that I find very beautiful.
Mm.
He says we very often think of our limitations, the things that we're not able to do, as resulting from our sinfulness, or resulting as an evil that we have to suffer under. The fact that I'm limited in my intellectual ability, in my strength, in my the time I have, in the resources I have, I can see that as a problem. I can wish that I didn't have those limitations. But Ricoeur says that's basically like wishing that you're God. Like, it's part of being created to have limitations.
To have limits, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's part of the nature of being created, So sometimes I know Christians who beat themselves up because they feel like they don't pray enough, they don't read the Bible enough, they don't work hard enough, and they don't care for their family enough. And I'm like, you've got 24 hours in your day. You can't do all those things. You've got limits.
Yeah.
That's not a bad thing. It's not evil to have limits.
Yeah.
So Ricoeur does a lot to distinguish between what he calls finitude and evil, distinguishing finitude and evil, so that we come to accept our limitations as something that God gave us as a good thing, and recognize that the only real evil is in not wanting to accept our limitations, wanting to be like God. Mm-hmm. And you see, you see some of these themes are coming straight out of the Bible. If you think in Genesis 3, what's going on? The problem with Adam and Eve was that they wanted to be like God. They wanted to remove those limitations and define good and evil for themselves. The problem wasn't that they were limited. The problem was that they weren't happy being limited.
Oh, Barney, that's a conversation for another podcast.
Yeah,
I know. Like, it is a somewhat different topic. I would say that some of the work that I did on how you distinguish between finitude and evil, it rolls over into the question of refugees, because being a refugee can be seen as intrinsically an evil, and it sort of is, because something terrible has happened to you. But that presupposes a number of very good things about refugees and about human beings that we all have in common. And so in some ways, there's the deep philosophical foundations for my work on refugees does come in this book on Recur.
Mm-hmm. Well, what it means to be human, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, that's a classic way to end, is it? What does it mean to be human?
What does it mean to be human? Well, there's no more important question to ask, really.
It's true. It's true. Barney, it's been so good to talk to you. And thanks so much for your time. Thanks for staying up, even though you're a bit sleep deprived at the moment with the second child.
Well, thank you so much. You've asked wonderful questions, and you've forced me to think about things I'd never thought about before. As always, makes for a good conversation.
Totally.
Thanks for listening to the Regent College podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. To discover more about Regent College, its upcoming events, conferences, courses, and more content like this, visit rgnt.net. That is rgnt.net.